I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, April 23rd. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, and to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your local, provincial, and national headlines.
A UBC Graduate School of Journalism project provides a hard-hitting look into efforts by Aboriginal communities to address major health and social issues such as suicide, sexual abuse, diabetes, and the survival of traditional languages. Students in UBC's inaugural Reporting in Indigenous Communities class have launched a series of original news stories designed to improve the quality of Aboriginal representation by the news media. As part of this course, these UBC graduate students were assigned to cover important community news as, quote, embedded journalists. The five Aboriginal course partners are the Squamish First Nation, Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, Tsawwassen First Nation, Stolo First Nation, and the Metro Vancouver Aboriginal Executive Council. Course instructor Duncan McHugh, a CBC TV reporter and member of the Anishinaabe Ojibwa Nation, said that, quote, "Everybody knows the statistics are shameful, that Aboriginal people lag behind other Canadians in almost every health indicator, and we wanted to try and put some faces to those statistics and to have this be solutions-oriented reporting, where Aboriginal people themselves were involved in the solutions rather than just being victims of ill health." End quote. The national CBC program, called The Story From Here, is scheduled to broadcast the entire series as a one-hour radio documentary on June 20th.
Thousands of teachers across BC will no longer be volunteering in extracurricular activities as they begin the next phase of their ongoing job action on Monday morning. Last week, the members of the BC Teachers Federation voted 73% in favor of withdrawing the volunteer services such as coaching school teams, directing theater productions, and planning graduation ceremonies. But some teachers have said they plan to continue their volunteer activities, and parents and school administrators may step in to volunteer to keep other activities running. This job action follows the new government's regulations that were released today. The regulations accompany Bill 22, a controversial law that ended a BC Teachers Federation job action, imposed a six-month cooling-off period, and changed the rules about class size and composition in response to a court order. The BCTF has argued that Bill 22 will result in exceptionally large classes next year, because there is no longer a requirement for school districts to maintain a class size average of 30 students or less. But the government insists its regulations will improve class size organizations because of the requirements for ongoing consultation.
An estimated 250,000 people inched its way through downtown and onto Mount Royal Sunday afternoon in what was Quebec's largest ever Earth Day march. Montreal police don't provide official crowd estimates, but individual officers said they thought numbers had topped 200,000 in the city. Earth Day organizers themselves were stunned, pinning the numbers of participants at 250,000 or 300,000. Turnout for the three-hour event was 10 times what Earth Day organizers had anticipated, said Yves Longtemps, one of more than 800 volunteers who kept marchers along the official route. The crowd in Montreal was a mixed group of environmental activists denouncing the Quebec government's Plan Nord, Northern Exploration Plans, and shale gas exploration, as well as the federal government's axing of the Katimavik Youth Environmental Program and Canada's withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol. In Vancouver, opposition to the expansion of oil giant Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline reached a fever pitch on Sunday as thousands of people jammed Commercial Drive to rally for Earth Day. Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson has said he is firmly against the proposed expansion. On Sunday, he told the crowd that Vancouver's mandate to become the world's greenest city does not fit with an expansion of oil exports in Vancouver. The public gathering was the first of its kind since the April 12th announcement that the Texas-based company will seek more than double the amount of crude oil that flows from Alberta to Burnaby, BC, to 850,000 barrels a day from the current 300,000. The event in Vancouver concluded with the announcement that an anti-pipeline petition to the federal government has reached its goal of 10,000 signatures.
The Wild West Albertan Conservative Showdown is coming to a head tonight. The Progressive Conservatives' 41-year reign is expected to end, although the race is still close enough that changes in numbers aren't out of the question. 4 weeks ago, the Wild Rose Party burst out of the gates to take a commanding lead in the polls. Then, as questions surfaced regarding two controversial candidates and leader Danielle Smith's view on climate change, support fell slightly. Now, most pollsters seem to agree that the Wild Rose Party will win the election. The uncertainty is whether they will win a minority or majority government. Meanwhile, the Progressive Conservatives still believe that they will win a full majority. Whatever ends up happening, this arduous tale of hardcore conservatism will come to a close tonight, either with the toppling of a political dynasty or with the shockingly narrow defense.
Ontario will not be plunged into its second election in 7 months. The minority Liberal government have reached a deal with Ontario's NDP, essentially securing enough votes to support the provincial budget and avoid another election call. Premier Dalton McGuinty agreed to implement a 2% surtax on the rich, which was enough to win over NDP leader Andrea Horwath and her caucus. The funds raised from the surtax, which will apply to those earning more than $500,000 a year, will be used to pay off the province's $15 billion deficit. The Ontario Liberals won re-election under a minority government last October and have received heavy criticism from both opposition parties and the federal finance minister for its proposed budget. Without this deal, it's likely the budget would never have been voted down, forcing an election. The Liberals also agreed to increase funding for the social assistance program, Ontario Works, as well as provide an additional $20 million to help fund rural and northern hospitals.
The five Arctic countries, including Canada, are being urged by more than 2,000 scientists from around the world to impose a moratorium on industrial fishing in the increasingly accessible waters of the central Arctic Ocean. The letter, which was signed by 551 Canadian scientists and another 1,500 from 67 other countries, said that such a moratorium would give experts time to determine the size and sustainability of Arctic fisheries. The researchers want Canada, the U.S., Russia, Norway, and Denmark to develop an international fisheries accord that would avoid wiping out potentially lucrative species such as Arctic cod before enough is known about their populations. UBC fisheries biologist Daniel Pauly, who signed the letter, said, quote, "Developing an international fisheries agreement is an important step towards protecting the ecosystem of the high Arctic. Without such regulation, this region will be increasingly vulnerable to overfishing as climate change causes the loss of permanent ice," end quote. According to many scientists, much of the 2.8 million square kilometer area of international waters at the center of the Arctic Ocean could experience ice-free summers in the coming years or decades. And while little research has been done in the region, experts believe significant volumes of commercially valuable fish would attract fishing fleets from many nations if ice melt projections prove accurate.
And those are your local, provincial, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local weather forecast as well as your international headlines.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building.
I'm Nell Abram.
Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
And welcome back to News 101. We are broadcasting live from the Student Union Building on campus at UBC. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. We now have your local weather forecast, brought to you by Environment Canada. Tonight, it looks cloudy with a 60% chance of showers late this evening and overnight with a low of 10 degrees. Tuesday also looks generally cloudy with 60% of showers early in the morning, with a high of 14 degrees. Tuesday night is cloudy as well with 60% chance of showers with a low of 10. Wednesday looks rainy with a high of 13 degrees and a low of 10. Thursday will receive periods of rain with a low of 9 and a high of 12. And to end your weekday weather update, you have showers on Friday, with a low of 7 and a high of 12 degrees. And that was your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada. And now for your international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations Chief of Political Affairs, Lynn Pascoe, told the Security Council today that violations of human rights are still being perpetrated with impunity in Syria. More than 40 people were reportedly killed in the country today, despite a so-called lull in the violence. On Saturday, the Security Council approved another 300 unarmed monitors be deployed to observe the situation on the ground. And Syrian Ambassador Bashar Jafari said that troops would exercise the utmost restraint while protecting the country against terrorists. India's Central Bureau of Investigation has officially accused a former member of the ruling party of supporting and backing bloody riots against the Sikh community more than two decades ago. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal has details.
Sajjan Kumar and five others are facing trial in the killings of Sikhs at Delhi during the riots. The CBI told the New Delhi court that the former member of parliament from the Congress Party and his co-defendants in tandem with the police were responsible for organizing the riots. More than 3,000 Sikhs were killed in the Indian capital during 4 days of mob violence following the assassination of the then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. CBI prosecutor R.S. Chima says that Kumar instigated the crowd, saying that not a single Sikh should survive in the area. Sikhs around the world are demanding that those responsible for the killings be punished, but survivors are concerned they won't see justice. The Indian government is trying to get diplomatic immunity for its minister. Jasvinder Sehgal, FSRN, India.
The United Nations called on the U.S. today to repeal laws that criminalize homelessness. Charles Appel reports that three U.N. human rights experts say a recent report by the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness and the U.S. Department of Justice, called Searching Out Solutions, acknowledges that criminalization may violate international human rights law.
The study looked at measures which criminalize what it calls acts of living related to homelessness, such as sleeping, eating, panhandling, urinating, or conducting personal hygiene in public spaces. It condemns the criminalization of homelessness and recommends effective alternative practices and policies to reduce and prevent homelessness. It also calls on states and the federal government to adopt constructive alternatives to criminalization, designed with the participation of homeless persons and relevant communities. The UN experts say the report could generate a tangible difference in the lives of hundreds of thousands of homeless Americans. Charles Appel, United Nations.
Hundreds of striking garment workers in Turkey marked 70 days of resistance with a concert over the weekend. Sean David Hobbs was there.
More than 400 workers say they were fired in early February by the Hay Textile Factory in Istanbul without cause and without 3 months of back wages. The plant, owned by the wealthy Turkish Bektaş family, was started with funds from a Turkish government employment incentive plan to create jobs in poverty-ridden areas throughout Turkey from 2005 to 2008. The apparel manufacturer was one of the largest in Turkey and produced clothing for Reebok, Timberlake, and Tommy Hilfiger. Seda Akdemir said that the problems began in 2008.
The owner said because of the world economic crisis, our pay was coming late, and there would be no end-of-the-year bonuses.
From 2008 on, wages were regularly late, despite increased production. This year, after not being paid for November, December, or January, the workers went on strike. Under Turkish law, if a worker does not come to work for 3 days, he or she can be fired with no benefits or compensation. Since 2008, the Bektaş family has closed many factories like the Hay Textile Factory and reaped huge benefits while the workers have suffered. The strikers say they will continue their protest in front of the factory until their back wages are paid. Sean David Hobbs, FSRN, Istanbul.
The number of major sponsors to drop the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, has reached a baker's dozen, with Procter & Gamble not re-upping their membership. Common Cause filed a complaint against ALEC with the IRS today, saying they're actually a lobbying group and challenging their tax-exempt status. ALEC calls itself a think tank for state-based public policy issues and potential solutions. ALEC has crafted hundreds of boilerplate laws that have been promoted and passed in states across the nation, including Arizona's repressive immigration law known as SB 1070 and Florida's Stand Your Ground gun law. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thank you to FSRN for those headlines. And now we have something different in store since it is the end of the school year and we're all feeling a little gloomy. Let's be honest, we've all heard CJ's little sickness over the air, stuffy nose and all that. And it's a bit of a gloomy day. And so, you know, we were thinking, well, not all of us were thinking, but I was thinking how school is ending and it's a bit of an existential crisis when classes end because all of a sudden there's nothing to do and as much as people are working and doing their summer jobs, at the same time, once you don't have a schedule every single day, it kind of becomes, you start to question your very existence. And so we're just going to discuss that for a bit. We have a myriad of opinions here.
Oh, yes, very, several points of view will be represented in this discussion.
Absolutely. For starters, I recommend a lot of movies and like bags of popcorn.
Those are band-aids. We get to the heart of the issue here.
Exactly. I mean, I've been watching movies and falling asleep to watching movies and drinking wine, and it helps.
And you did all that during school.
Yeah. And also, at the same time, it's true. It's a band-aid. It's emotion-focused coping and not problem-focused coping.
Does a schedule make you feel as though you're doing something important, Nina?
To be honest, even during the school year, I sometimes question, like, even when I know I have a schedule and I have to go to classes, when you think about it, you don't have to do anything. You know, we're not living, we're lucky to be living in a country where we get to make our own decisions. And I've been lucky enough to be able to go to school. And
yeah, but you're paying for school. That's why. You're
well, working. Yeah, but at the same time, money is something that, yeah, I'll be in debt, but I'm not going to die if I don't go to school. You know what I mean? It's
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, reason.
But I mean, yeah, I guess I do kind of feel like at least I have a purpose, like there's something waiting for me. Like I have to be somewhere every day. And when that purpose goes away in order to get good grades, mm-hmm. but when that purpose goes away you don't really have a reason to do anything, it's really strange because it's just, you know, it's your prerogative. Anything you want to do, you can do. But if you don't want to do anything, all of a sudden it's just, you could do nothing.
Only for so long, though. And then you want to do something, and then you don't even know what you can do anymore because you've been so long doing nothing.
Oh, man.
It's a snare is what it is. You put your foot in there and you get stuck, baby.
So is this a way for like us to figure out how to get off the couch and do something?
Yeah.
Is that what you...
We could discuss those things. I mean, I'm still trying to figure it out. But, I mean,
One of the best ways to do that is to figure out what you like in life, right?
Yeah. Is this going to turn into a therapy session?
It is.
It's already there. It's already there.
The reason we started this is because...
Well, I'd say that, like, having a job has always been what you do, well, what I do and what I know all of my friends do in the summer because everybody needs money. We're all poor students. But, I don't know. Other than a job, the jobs are always such... Like, they're jobs where you don't really have to think, and that kind of adds to the whole aspect of what am I doing in life.
Yeah. Well, then get a job where you have to think.
But, I mean, you're young. Yeah, we don't have any experience. I don't have, like, all year to be working. I have my 4 months where I can work full-time potentially, but after that, I'm in school, so no one's going to hire for a really serious job.
Well, you know CITR is hiring?
That's
people out there in Radioland. Well, I guess if you're not a student... But that's a job where you think and you have fun.
Okay.
Well, thinking and paying jobs are pretty damn scarce these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
If you want to polish bowling pins for the rest of your life, you've got a future, young man or woman.
Yeah, that's not me.
No, you don't want to polish bowling pins?
No, of course.
What year are you in, Nina?
Second.
Second? So this is your second... turn on the existential merry-go-round, eh?
No, well, actually, last year I finished school and I wasn't going to go anywhere, but I had made a lot of money that year and saved it, and then all of a sudden, like 5 days before I left, I planned this trip with my best friend and we went to Europe. So I guess that kind of stopped that from happening.
That might be the solution, too. Missions. Individual missions.
Individual missions, but it's not the same when you don't have money anymore, so a trip is not an option.
Oh, you don't need money for missions.
Can you explain? He's going to explain.
Well, you went on traveling, right?
Yeah.
And there must have been some sort of a purpose, even if it's as vague as experiencing new things that you've never done before, right?
Of course.
That kept you going. It stopped you from thinking about it. That's a mission, a narrow little mission that took you 3 months to accomplish or whatever it took.
Yeah.
And it occupied your mind, and it was something that you came up with, something you wanted to do.
Exactly.
And so you did it, and you didn't feel as though you were wasting your time, or maybe you did and you liked it. Who cares?
But I don't have a mission.
Hmm?
I don't have a mission this year.
Yeah, you have to come up with one.
Oh, yeah. That's a slow spot, a slump, we call them. those come every once in a while.
Well, I'll have to think of something, but
a West Coast bicycle trip.
You don't want to ride your bike along the West Coast. All right, so this has turned into something really, really valuable. We need to think up a mission for Nina's summer.
Okay. If anybody can, by the way, at any point, if you would like to call in and give me a mission, I would be very, very happy. So it's just an FYI for anybody out there listening.
Mission impossible.
Basically, what I was going to ask is, I just want to get CJ and Martin's opinion on this, is the kind of the issue of drinking and drugs and where they come in this existential crisis. Because as I was saying earlier to Martin and CJ, is I find that once school is out, everybody's going out and everybody's partying. And then all of a sudden, because they're bored, and you have these young students who are bored and don't really have anything to do for the next 4 months, and they know that, I guess that's when drinking excessively comes in. That's when doing various drugs, recreational use of drugs, comes in. And just kind of see where they fit in that existential map. Crisis map.
Well, that's where Martin's idea of mission comes in handy. Where if you focus solely on that, then you don't have to worry about partying and alcohol and all kinds of other fun stuff.
But realistically, it's probably going to happen anyways, because the fact of the matter is, drugs and drinking are fun.
Yeah.
They can be crippling, they can be dangerous, they can be harmful, but above all, they are fun at least the first 5 times.
Yep. Exactly. No, yeah. But yeah, it's just a food for thought. Just now that school's over, we're just, you know, ruminating about life, and I find myself just having nothing to do and just with my thoughts, and sometimes it's scary, but sometimes it's really cool.
I recommend a trip to the Andes where you can meet a shaman and...
Have you been to see a shaman?
No, I am a shaman.
Oh, what? My lord. Why would you need to go to the Andes or wherever you're going to send her
then? It looks like I have my very own shaman here in Vancouver. What? CJ?
You've gotten yourself into... You've fallen into the snare.
CJ is claiming to be a shaman and...
Yeah. I have all my gear ready.
Yeah, well, my mom just recently came back from a trip from the Andes. She saw a shaman and did cool spiritual endeavors. But I don't know. See, I mean, I can't go on a trip, so I'm going to have to find my very own mission here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we should end on? Is that what it is? Yeah?
Yeah, you could. You're going to France in a while, too, eh?
Yeah. Yes, hopefully.
Yeah.
Just think about that. If you are experiencing the same existential crisis as me, you might not be. You might be laughing in my face right now.
Well, not in my face, but
at my voice.
Yeah, there we go.
But just think about that. Think about Martin Lennon's wise words. Find a mission. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back here on CITR News 101.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
April and Discorder is here. Daffodils are blooming, cherry blossoms blossoming, and Discorder smells spring fresh off the presses. Check inside for monthly faves, The Overeducated Grumbler, on the topic of Dan Levy, getting textually active with rock stars, and news on the venues you know and love. Read up on the lovelies of Ruffled Feathers, Indigo Kids, and Dirty Spells, and figure out where to pick up hard copies of their stuff at your favorite local record store on Record Store Day. Reviews, calendars, charts, interviews, art projects...
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. And since we just flew off the topic of drugs there, I think we got a nice little piece here concerning last Friday's 420. Proper stoner fashion, it was fashionably late, so I think that's mildly fitting.
Yes, and it was quite interesting.
With that cat there?
Must be full of reefer.
Full of reefer?
Yeah, man.
Mean that cat's high?
Sailing. Lightly.
Get away from here.
For many, last Friday marked another year come and gone. In certain circles, April 20th is a bona fide holiday. Better than Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Canada Day all rolled into one. Truly the most wonderful time of the year. When stoners emerge from their dank hermetic lairs to celebrate their use of this misunderstood plant by getting high, stoned, fried, baked, buzzed, bombed, blitzed, woozy, wasted, stewed, spaced, smashed, lit, ripped, and zonked in broad daylight, where one and all are more or less forced to take notice of this sizable troop of semi-incoherent space cadets. Of course, 420 is a protest of sorts. The act being celebrated is, in fact, illegal. But really, how seriously do we take a law that can be blatantly broken in public at least once a year? What are we even doing here? What's the point? Dana Larson is a big marijuana activist in BC. He was a founding member of both the Marijuana Party of Canada and the BC Marijuana Party. He even made an unsuccessful push for the leadership of the BC NDP a couple years ago.
And just because we're having fun, that doesn't mean that we're not addressing really serious issues. And we always, Mark Emery's banner is on the stage. He's a close friend of mine, and he's not coming back to Canada until mid-2014.
Mark Emery's shadow hangs heavy in this haze. He was extradited to the States for selling weed seeds. And among those who organized and fought for the right to have this yearly get-together on the steps of the Art Gallery, Mark Emery was, is, and will continue to be a sort of icon for Vancouver's pot scene.
But there are millions of other cannabis prisoners out there who are forgotten, who don't have people coming to visit them, who don't get banners up on stages, who are there because they love marijuana, because they believe in this plant.
A little over 50,000 people are charged with cannabis-related offenses in this country every year. Now, it's easy to take certain freedoms for granted, especially if you're able to get away with it on a regular basis. But the fact is, some aren't. A report done by Stats Canada in 2007 shows that over 100,000 drug crimes were performed that year. Of those, 62% involved Chiba, and 3/4 of those were for possession. Now, anyone who suckled the end of a reefer can tell you that it isn't the most harmful or dangerous substance out there, yet ganja still makes up a vast majority of drug offenses in this country. Where did this innocent plant go wrong? In North America, up until the late 19th century, herb was seen as fairly valuable in treating migraines, epilepsy, depression, and anxiety. But the invention of the hypothermic syringe in the 1850s helped increase the use of opiates, barbiturates, and other soluble drugs that could work faster for pain relief if it were injected. So, since chronic is highly insoluble, it basically began to fall out of favor within the medical community because you couldn't shoot it directly into your veins. This bias slowly grew with medical experts who began to consider cannabis as a narcotic, which meant implications of overdose and uncontrollable sexual excitement. California became the first state to outlaw herb in 1915, and by 1920 the dominoes had fallen, and the poor hemp plant had been pushed into the underground drug market. But this wasn't really an issue in Canada. Between 1930 and 1946, there were only 25 cannabis convictions in the entire country. It wasn't until the late 60s that we started to get hep. No doubt simply because we were following the footsteps of our elder American brethren, who were riding the wave of social revolution. In 1962, the RCMP reported 20 cases related to marijuana. In 1968, it had jumped to over 2,300. And by 1972, there were nearly 12,000 marijuana convictions in Canada. From 20 to 12,000 in 10 years. Enter the political machine.
Come on down here, let's smoke.
Right around the same time doobie convictions were growing exponentially, the Canadian government formed the Ledain Commission to undertake a factual study of hemp and all its half-baked effects. It concluded, and I quote, that Canada's prohibition laws had only served to create a subculture with little respect for the law and law enforcement, as well as diverting law enforcement capability, clogging the judicial system, and providing a base of funds for organized crime. End quote. Sounds vaguely familiar. So, in 1972, Pierre Trudeau added this recommendation to his election platform, but he did nothing about it. Which brings us back to the present day, because the Young Liberals were present at all the major 420 rallies across the country on Friday, and they were all saying essentially the same thing as Justin Kaiser, president of the Young Liberals of Canada in BC.
Obviously, the Conservative government, supported with the NDP under Thomas Mulcair now, is fully against legalization of marijuana. They continue their, war on drugs.
Oh yes, Thomas Mulcair made a nasty little boo-boo on Global TV last month when Tom Clark asked him if he supported the decriminalization of marijuana.
No, I think that that would be a mistake because the information that we have right now is that the marijuana that's on the market is extremely potent and can actually cause mental illness.
Liberals, young and old, wasted no time in pouncing on this, especially with the recent policy change made at their convention in January.
About 3,200 people were at the convention. 77% of them voted in favor of legalizing, regulating, and taxing marijuana in Canada.
Isn't it funny how a crippling loss can inspire sympathy for society's losers? Or maybe just make you a little more willing to take advantage of them. One of Thomas Mulcair's strongest points is what appears to be an unyielding dedication towards involving young people in Canadian politics. And the Liberals are jockeying hard for a piece of that pie, even if they have to stoop to hollow promises we've heard before. From Trudeau's inaction, to Chrétien's failed attempt at decriminalization, hell, even Joe Clark promised to change weed laws in 1979. But I guess he did have a narrow opportunity for action. The point is that all of these political promises we're hearing from opposition parties, all of these reports being released and Auditor Generals coming out to decry pot prohibition, has been going on in Canada for 40 years. The language being used is practically identical. Has anything really changed? Are we any closer to legalization or decriminalization than we were 40 or 50 years ago? What has to be done before this raunchy roach is pooched?
But I think it's going to require a change in the federal government.
Well,
caught between pessimism and optimism.
I mean, really, I mean, we would have to remove the current government, I think, to fully legalize everything.
Well, yeah. And who's to take their place?
Well, the next Liberal government will look at implementing that, and hopefully that's within 2015, so one election away. Hopefully we can get ourselves there.
Sounds to me like someone's been testing the wares a little too enthusiastically, Justin. Democracy is not known for its speed and efficiency, and politicians aren't usually on the forefront of cultural issues. In fact, they're notorious bunglers who are lucky if they could find the end of their own shoelaces, let alone the gaping chasm between our behavior and values and the laws that are supposed to reflect those values. Nowhere is this lack of synchronicity more obvious than with the pot problem. The green disagreement. Doobie doubt. The Canadian government is not merely out of step with its people. It's hanging out in another dimension entirely. And if history is any indication, booting the Conservatives out of power isn't going to help. We'll just end up with another group of squares who say one thing and do another. But for some illogical reason, there is still hope among these dazed denizens.
So I think we're building up to something that's got to give, and it's going to give on our side, and we're going to win this battle ultimately.
Attending 420 fills Chiba Chuggers with a wonderful sense of hard-headed faith that the inevitable is bound to happen. In the meantime, our message is clear.
We're here, we're high, get used to us.
For CITR News, I'm Martin Lundman.
Oh, you dog.
We psyched you out on our weekday weather forecast. It was just a preview, a teaser, if you will. It's now time for the full feature, the feature length. Are you there, Phil?
Hey, Martin. Thanks for doing the preview, then. Thanks very much.
Well, it's now time for the fantastic Phil forecast. Lay it on us, Phil.
Cool. Thank you, Martin, and good evening, listeners. The most distinguished weather feature in the week to come, I believe, is a frontal system that is predicted to arrive around tomorrow evening. We will likely be experiencing a drop in average temperatures, a slight one, but a definite drop, and increased moisture levels. Until a high-pressure ridge develops this coming Sunday, the daily norm is anticipated to be overcast skies, slightly lower temperatures, with occasional showers. Now, here's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy with a 40% chance of around 2 millimeters of rain, low of 12. Tuesday, cloudy with a 90% chance of showers in the evening, high of 14, low of 11. Wednesday, cloudy with an 80% chance of around 15 millimeters of rain, high of 13, low of 10. Thursday, cloudy again, with 50% chance of around 2 millimeters of rain, high of 12, low of 6. Friday, cloudy with a 50% chance of around 3 millimeters of rain. High of 12, low of 7. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 11 degrees Celsius on campus. I'm reporting from home for News 101. I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you very much, Phil. Always an educational experience when Phil Chang gives us a ring. And we're going to cut the existential stuff out for a second and go to FSRN for some hard international news.
Against its neighbor, South Sudan, as fighting sent thousands of residents fleeing violence along the border. The death toll from a clash last week is also emerging. According to AFP, a battle for a disputed border town called Heglig left soldiers scattered in the area. One Sudanese general put the number at more than 1,000, but that estimate could not be verified. South Sudan became an independent country in 2011, but tensions over oil resources and border sovereignty have risen lately. Images from the Satellite Sentinel Project, a group that monitors the region, show military buildup along the border and bombing of civilian centers. For more, we're joined by Nathaniel Raymond, Director of Operations at the Satellite Sentinel Project at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. Welcome to FSRN.
It's a pleasure to be here, sir.
You've come out with new satellite imagery today. They appear to track a buildup of Sudan armed forces and also an aerial bombardment. What do the images show?
What the images show is that a large portion, almost half, just less than half, of the entire combat-capable aircraft of the Sudan Armed Forces have moved into position at two bases, El Obeid and Kadugli, near the border with South Sudan. And these images are especially disturbing given what happened this morning in Rub Kona, a boy burned to death as a result of an aerial bombardment by, we believe, some of the same fighter craft shown in these images. And those aircraft were attempting to blow up a strategic bridge near Rub Kona. And we show in the images released last night evidence of cratering consistent with aerial bombardment near a strategic bridge in Bentiu, which is consistent with the reports we've received over the past week and the reports we're receiving today.
As you describe it, this boy who was appeared to be burned, now I assume that he's a civilian, he's not a soldier, so how does this affect civilians in the area?
As we can see in the imagery, the cratering is present in an area of structures consistent with civilian housing near the bridge. And that image is consistent with reports from the same time it was taken, approximately a week ago, alleging that at least 4 civilians in one of the bombardments had died when bombs dropped on their houses. So what we are seeing, and is consistent with the title of the report, Escalation, is evidence of combat operations by both sides, the Sudan Armed Forces and the Sudan People's Liberation Army.
Now, taking a look at the current crisis here, talk about Heglig, the border town that is in a disputed area. Forces from South Sudan withdrew last week under pressure. Then Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir visited the town using strong military rhetoric. Why is this area so important?
Heglig is important for 3 reasons. The first is that it contains half of the oil controlled by Sudan, by the northern government. The second reason it's important is that its status has been contested, and despite a permanent court of arbitration ruling from The Hague, the status of Heglig is still disputed by both sides, both parties to this conflict. The third reason it's important is that Heglig has allegedly served as a base of operations for the north to arm militias inside the south with weaponry to carry out attacks on southern infrastructure, forces, and civilians. So the incursion by the SPLA in the past couple weeks in occupation of Heglig has both inflamed the situation in terms of oil, the situation in terms of the disputed border, in the situation in terms of allegations of both sides engaging in the arming of militias.
And the UN has said today that due to that escalation, thousands of residents in that area have fled. They're now without shelter. What is the effect on residents, their access to medical supplies or humanitarian needs at this point?
At this point, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance at the United Nations estimates that at least 10,000 from the area surrounding Heglig and Heglig proper have been displaced. Given the fact that the rains will be starting soon, and those people, as you mentioned, are without food, shelter, and medical supplies in an area where there is still ongoing hostility and firefights, it is a human security threat to those civilians and a humanitarian one as well. It is crucial that both parties to this conflict immediately cease combat operations because, as we see with every hour that goes by, the people who are caught in the crossfire are unarmed and are civilians.
Nathaniel Raymond is Director of Operations at the Satellite Sentinel Project at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. Thank you for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
And you can find a link to those images on our website, fsrn.org. Across the globe on Sunday, communities marked Earth Day with rallies, events, and activities aimed at cleaning up the planet and identifying issues important to local residents. Today, FSRN brings you two segments in honor of Earth Day. In a moment, we'll hear from Nigerian activist Nimo Bassi on the environmental challenges faced by African residents. But first, we go to the small Mexican community of San Ignacio, south of the Baja Peninsula, which used to be the site of whale killing. After that was banned, clams became a key source of income until they, too, came close to extinction. With the threat of a salt mine on its lagoon coming next, the community found itself on the verge of an environmental disaster. But instead of further exploitation, residents adopted sustainable practices and a new way of life. From Ignacio, Baja California, FSRN's Mariana Martinez has this report.
The small coastal community of San Ignacio is a rough-and-tumble 14-hour drive from Tijuana down the Baja Peninsula. The last few miles are rocky dirt roads frequently hit by sandstorms. But at the shore of the lagoon, the crisp, salty air and the constant sound of waves crashing makes it easy to forget the sticky desert heat. The lagoon has long been the temporary home to hundreds of whales who travel here to escape the cold Alaska winter.
Many years ago, it was only 3-4 houses.
But this lagoon hasn't always been a healthy ecosystem. Early last century, this place was known for its massive whale killing. The family of 43-year-old fisherman Ranulfo Mayoral has lived here for generations.
I say I belong to the lagoon because my great-grandfather was the founder of this community. My grandfather, my mom was born here. I was born here. This is where I live and raise my children. And here we are.
But unlike his great-grandfather who hunted whales, Mayoral helps keep them safe, monitoring their behavior patterns, population, and overall health.
I've been whale watching since 82, bird watching since 97, and turtle monitoring since 2000. This is my second year observing sea lions as part of an invitation by Steve Swartz, who is a scientist and a close friend of the family from long ago.
Steven Swartz is the director of Cetacean Research Associates. He's come to the lagoon since 1977 and has a joint research group with Mexican scientists.
If there was no economic incentive to live here, no one would live here. They couldn't live here. And a big company could come in and make a golf course or could make a phosphate mine or a salt mine, and no one would care.
Another challenge came when a large Mexican fishing company came to town and became the only employer. The company's practices exploited the Catalina clam population and brought it close to extinction. Now, the community has organized two cooperatives to cultivate clams sustainably in the marshes. One of the workers and owners is 22-year-old Julia Alejandra Sanchez.
I'm happier here because I used to work at another plant and it was more work.
Here I feel more relaxed. I like the schedule. I used to get off work at 4, but I finish work at 3 here, and I have more time with my small child.
Their last wake-up call came in the early 1990s when Mitsubishi, backed by the federal government, planned to build a huge salt mine and solar power plant in the already devastated lagoon. Having learned from their experiences with the Catalina clam, the small community fought Mitsubishi until a part of the lagoon was declared protected. The community's efforts led to Kuyima, the first environmentally friendly whale-watching site that soon became a business model others adopted. Carlos Varela is a marine biologist who has been working at the camp for the past 16 years.
Los pescadores trabajan como guías motoristas. Sus esposas.
The fishermen are boat operators. Their wives prepare food such as tamales, empanadas, desserts, tortillas. They wash the linen used in the camp, and that's how we give work to many in the community.
De esta manera se le da trabajo a muchísima de la gente en la comunidad.
35 years after the salt mine and solar power plant threatened the lagoon, the federal government is considering reviving the plan. But in an unprecedented move, all 40 communal landowners signed a commitment to only allow the development of sustainable projects on their land. Raúl López is head of the communal cooperative.
Unplanned resource exploitation and financial need can take you to a crisis. After we almost drove a species to extinction, we are now doing responsible use and giving families year-long income thanks to that.
It has been a long learning process for San Ignacio, but the fruit of their labor can be felt all around, as Mayoral explains.
Here, tour companies compete in a different way than in other places. We know we share the same sea, the same whales, the same people, and that is important.
On one of the tours, biologist Varela takes out his flute. He says he serenades the whales as an offering of gratitude. Mariana Martinez, Free Speech Radio News, San Ignacio, Lagoon.
Thank you to FSRN for those headlines. And now we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
This April at the Rio, Open Mic Nights will now be happening twice monthly. A showcase of local musicians, comedians, poets, and variety acts. Doors at 7 p.m. and the show starts at 8 for these free 19-plus events, April 4th and 18th. Want more live entertainment? Check out Dirty Dancing Burlesque at the Rio, April 5th, a burlesque show featuring live music with all the hit songs from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack and burlesque inspired by the movie. Saturday, April 7th. Back by popular demand, it's the Big Screen Barrel House 2, a modern throwback to the silent film era. Film classics will have their soundtracks reimagined by some of Vancouver's most talented acts. Wednesday, April 11th, it's Canada's own classical pianist and DJing wonder kid, Chili Gonzalez. Get your advance tickets through the Rio website today or at Red Cat, High Life, and Zulu Records. Wondering what to do on 420? For only a toonie, come out to the Champion of Champions variety show. The audience will determine a first place $500 and a second place $150 winner and will get the chance to win some swell swag for themselves. For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheater.ca.
That's our program for April 23rd. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us a hot news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows and interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Lyra Gibbons.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. Today's...
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Lyra Gibbons from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening.
With special thanks to Nina.
Thank you.
And
stay tuned
for Sore Throats Clapping Hands. Robert's been patiently waiting here. I think he's got a good one for you.
And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.